For WMRA News, I'm Bob Levicki. Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax updates his defamation lawsuit against CBS over sexual assault allegations against him. Residents in Harrisonburg plan to petition City Council to provide year-round shelter for people without access to housing. And we have a conversation about protecting the Valley's environment with the Executive Director of Sustainability Matters. This is the WMRA Daily for Friday, October 4th. Lawyers for Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax filed paperwork on Thursday updating his $400 million defamation lawsuit against CBS. The updated complaint includes texts between Fairfax's spokesperson and a reporter for CBS. Fairfax's lawyers claim the texts prove the network did not fully investigate two claims of sexual assault against the Lieutenant Governor. CBS says it stands by its reporting. Residents in Harrisonburg plan to petition City Council to provide year-round shelter for people without access to housing. WMRA's Bridget Manley reports.
What happens at night?
At night? Well, at least it's cool. But it's rough when you sleep on the ground, you know, in a sleep bag. Yeah, especially when I got a lot of physical problems. I wake up in pain, and that's rough, you know.
Dave Napsick was homeless and panhandling in Harrisonburg this summer. During a crisis in the city that sparked weeks of meetings and discussions between city officials, business owners, and those who work with the homeless population. Now he's part of a wider group of residents and those experiencing homelessness in the city who have assembled more than 1,000 signatures on a petition demanding a low-barrier shelter in the city during warm months. The group plans to present the petition at Tuesday's City Council meeting. A low-barrier shelter is a shelter that will house those without a place to stay, no matter the circumstances, like those who may be under the influence of drugs and alcohol, those with criminal records, and those with pets. People who might be turned away from other shelters would be welcome and given a bed for the night. Currently in Harrisonburg, Open Doors operates a low-barrier shelter during the cold months, November through April, but there are no low-barrier shelters during the summer months. Harrisonburg reached crisis level this summer, with many people sleeping on the lawn at our community place at night. When it became apparent that OCP was not able to handle the amount of people seeking a place to sleep, they were forced off the property and back into the shadows. City residents are asking City Council to pass a resolution to fund a low-barrier shelter for 2021, in the months when Open Doors does not operate. Michael Snell Fikema is a member of Occupy Harrisonburg and one of those who will be giving City Council the petition signatures on Tuesday. He says the shelter should be a basic human right given to everyone.
This is about recognizing the humanity of the people that are experiencing homelessness. And I think it's really important to realize that when you don't recognize the humanity of others, you're dehumanizing not only them, but yourself. And so there's a lot to be gained by taking the higher road on this.
Although it may seem like the city is not doing enough or that we're not doing anything, there's layers of challenges that we're faced with. And so we have to work through that.
Harrisonburg Mayor Dena Reed has been working with city stakeholders over the last year to identify challenges that those experiencing homelessness face. She says they meet once a month to talk and plan for real solutions that will help. She says they're coming up with possible solutions that will not only get people into shelters, but aim to treat the whole person and help sustain housing for the long run.
Just last month, we just talked about possibility of recovery houses, of more services for mental health and substance abuse, possible partnerships with hotels. We have discussed these things.
Bruce Bushing is Professor Emeritus of Sociology at James Madison University. He's been distributing the petition and gathering signatures in the hope that City Council will take seriously the community support surrounding the idea of a low-barrier shelter.
We're trying to respect the process, and submitting a petition and circulating a petition is very respectful of the process. That's as American as apple pie. And we think that a number of members of the City Council's hearts are in the right place. And so what we're asking for them is to follow up where we think their hearts are with some specific action on this issue.
Mayor Reed says that city officials are not kicking the can down the road, but instead are trying to come up with real solutions behind the scenes that people might not see.
I want to make sure that, you know, if we are building or putting together some type of facility for people to stay at, not only do they have a place to stay, but they're able to get the help they need.
Meanwhile, Knapsack's situation has improved dramatically. After collecting hundreds of signatures downtown for the petition, he has found permanent shelter at an assisted living facility in Elkton. He's proud to have helped collect signatures so that others don't experience what he lived through this summer.
And you know, it's amazing how many people, when I presented this petition to people, there's a lot of people, you know, they sign it and they take pictures of it. They wanted to share it with their friends, and then they would ask me questions, why I'm homeless or what's going on. And you'd be amazed how many people prayed with me. They say, can I pray with you? It's just so cool.
For WMRA News, I'm Bridget Manley.
Remember the work requirements that Republicans in Virginia insisted on before passing Medicaid expansion? Well, those requirements have yet to be implemented. The governor's office is still negotiating with federal officials to strike a deal. Virginia Public Radio's Michael Pope reports.
So far, Arkansas is the only state that's been able to implement a work requirement for people to prove they have a job in order to get health insurance under Medicaid expansion. Assuming the courts allow that requirement to stand, just how many people in Virginia might end up losing health insurance? Freddie Mejia, the Commonwealth Institute, says it could be as many as 74,000 people.
We think that if Virginia moves forward, based on some of the similarities between Arkansas and Virginia, that it is feasible that 23% of Virginia's population could lose coverage.
That's one in four people benefiting from the newly expanded program who could be kicked out of their health insurance plan for not filing the right paperwork at the right time to the right person. Adam Searing at Georgetown University says Virginia would be taking on a new administrative burden, demanding all that information, and then following through by kicking people out of Medicaid plans.
The problem is that that is another layer of administrative red tape. And if you make a mistake, you don't just get a nasty letter, you lose your health coverage.
Last week, Virginia's Secretary of Health and Human Resources sent a letter to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services in Washington, pressing for federal money to pay for work training as part of ongoing negotiations between the two on a waiver application that's still unresolved. A spokeswoman for the governor says negotiations are ongoing. I'm Michael Pope.
Finally today, the Shenandoah Valley is home to a rich ecosystem of trees, plants, and wildlife. Sari Karp is the executive director for the nonprofit Sustainability Matters, a group that works to conserve environmental resources for our area. WMRA's Chris Boros asked her to explain the program.
Sustainability Matters is a new regional conservation nonprofit. We've only been around for about 18 months, but we have been very busy since then, doing about 80 different programs and events that we've organized around conservation, education, and community building.
So 18 months, that's it so far?
18 months, yeah.
How did you get this idea to start this group? Like, why?
Good question. We ask ourselves that a lot. You know, it was a bunch of us who had worked together in different conservation organizations or different projects, and we decided that we wanted something a bit more unified that built bridges, that basically said, all right, we're not going to preach to you. We're going to make conservation accessible, something that anybody can do, and that we were going to do programs that were fun, that built community, that the same people would come to time and time again and start becoming friends and working together. And it seems the time and the place were right because it's just taken off and we're working in eight counties so far.
And right now your big project is Make Trash Bloom.
Yes, Making Trash Bloom.
Tell me about this.
We are literally planting pollinator habitat on top of the landfill. Essentially, what happens when something can't be recycled, it goes into a giant pit in the ground. And they then get covered up with clay, sealed up for eternity, and sit there as a giant heap. And usually what's seeded on top is grass, because that's just what's always been done. But pollinators are hugely under threat, and what they need is native plants. They need native perennials and meadows of flowering native perennials and native grasses. And so a landfill where you have the dead space, where you need something that provides erosion control, but where the roots don't go more than 3 feet deep, is a perfect spot for that. So the ultimate goal is to have all the trash blooming in the Shenandoah Valley.
How unique is this project?
This is a very special project. There have been a number of decommissioned landfills, but what we're talking about doing is doing something a bit more proactive and doing it on a working landfill and having every trash cell going forward be covered in the pollinator habitat.
Is it possible at one point, maybe in the future, the entire landfill could be this?
While the landfill is still active, the trash cells that are already covered are mandated federally, I believe, that they do not kill what's on there. So you can't seed the habitat in with fescue, which is turf grass. You know, this isn't a landfill-specific initiative. You can do this at home.
That was my next question. Could someone just do this in their backyard?
Absolutely.
When you approached the landfill about this idea, what was their initial reaction?
Yay, we don't have to mow.
Oh, okay. So they were all about it.
They were. You know, there were concerns. Mm-hmm. You know, they had to check with DEQ and make sure this
what's DEQ?
Department of Environmental Quality. What happens is that the giant heap of trash shifts and moves, and they compact it a couple more times before it gets permanently sealed. So that's maybe every 3 years or so. And these habitats really take several years to get fully established. So you have to plant it where you're going to leave it for the long term.
What else is next for the group besides Make Trash Bloom? What else is on the pipeline?
We have a fall tree and acorn ID walk and talk planned at Carrier Arboretum on the 30th. We have a sold out mushroom walk. Like everything's sold out pretty much. It's fall.
Wow.
Like, it's
taken off then.
Oh, yeah. Our stuff fills up far in advance.
Well, congratulations on the early success. It's really interesting. Yeah.
Thank you.
Sari Karp is the Executive Director for Sustainability Matters. Sari, thanks.
Thank you so much.
To learn more about Sustainability Matters, visit WMRA.org. And this story had production assistance from WMRA's Sara Amin. For WMRA News, I'm Bob Levicky. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoy your Friday.